David has asked me, and I agreed to give an overview lecture on control in NMR. I don't know exactly how well you all know NMR. What? Sorry, exactly which?
Oh, the light. Yeah. No, it's just the lights.
Oh, it's peeping. Peeping.
Is that?
No, those are blackboard.
How do I operate those? Because I will need the blackboard later.
Yeah,
anyways.
Yeah.
Ah, okay.
Yeah. We'll start.
Good.
Yeah, not too dark.
Okay.
Okay, so let me just briefly check, I mean, who's fairly familiar with NMR already?
Fairly from chemistry.
Okay, yeah, of course. And who has not much heard about NMR before? I will.
We don't believe our.
So I will try to give a mix and.
He doesn't know about spin.
Yeah. Oh. Who knows about? So what I will try to do is, introduce some of the basic concepts, give you a little bit of background of the physical picture. But also, in particular, focus on the control aspects in NMR. We've heard already the talk by Professor Manz. He's not here. I'm sure he will come. He gave a lecture last week on control in laser physics, laser control of molecular reactions. And so I will focus on the history and the topics, the current topics of research in control in the NMR setting. Okay. So I just want to mention magnetic moments of nuclear spins, different ways to represent nuclear spins. There are different concepts people use in chemistry and different areas of manipulating spins. And the most simple picture is magnetization vectors. You can describe spins as state functions or as density operators in mixed quantum systems, or if there's decoherence or relaxation processes going on. Then, depending on these pictures, you have different equations of motion, and once you have those, you can then simulate the evolution of such a spin system, such a quantum system. And I want to show you that, even though people talk about NMR, so in the NMR setting, NMR is a huge, a very wide field. It has evolved over more than 60 years, six decades. So there is not NMR, there are many different aspects, many different settings of NMR, and I will at least mention some of those. There are some limitations of standard liquid state NMR, mainly practical limitations. I want to show those. Actually, I did not plan to go too much into quantum computing, but that's also one big application. Since NMR technology is so well established, it was just the most simple technical tool to implement very basic ideas of quantum information processing. And all these ideas of control of spins, they have been a topic in, since the early days of NMR, so it's really a very long history. But relatively recently, say last 10 years, optimal control ideas have been introduced to manipulate coupled spin systems, and I will touch a little bit on these optimal control issues. So from the point of view of applications, again, there's a huge, a very wide field of applications ranging from material science to medicine. One of the sort of key applications or many labs all over the world with very, very expensive instruments work on the topic, for example, to use NMR to determine three-dimensional folds of proteins, of biological structures. So the only alternative to find the three-dimensional shape of such big molecules is X-ray crystallography, but there, of course, you need very good crystals. In many situations, you cannot grow such crystals. And in particular, the natural environment of these biomolecules is in aqueous solution, like in our cells. And NMR has a unique capability to establish or to determine such folds, such structures in their native surrounding in solution. Then at the other extreme, so we have microscopic objects that you can now image. So that has been also a huge success over the last decades. And many of these applications actually have been then rewarded also by Nobel Prizes. So there's actually prehistory to all this, going back to Stern Gerlach, who got Nobel Prize for their PIM experiments, molecular beam experiments. There's Nobel Prize for Rabi, who did actually nuclear magnetic resonance in molecular beams. But in particular, then bulk NMR, that's what we usually, when we refer to NMR these days, it's like either NMR of solutions or solid objects. That was introduced in 46. And awarded by Nobel Prizes for Purcell and Bloch. Then in 91, Richard Ernst, he has done a tremendous amount of work in his group in basically what we call today control of quantum systems, of spin systems. Usually like in the NMR community, again, which has developed all these control tools over the years and has developed their own language. And to you, maybe it will sound a little bit like jargon. And if there's some jargon I'm using, just ask me and I'll try to translate it into the current language. So usually in the NMR field, we would call this pulse sequence design, pulse sequence development. But basically what this is, so he's worked a lot on finding control techniques to efficiently excite spin systems, get their system parameters, and in particular 1D and two-dimensional NMR methods is something that he worked on a lot. And then there's Kurt Wiedrich, who got the Nobel Prize for using all these sophisticated pulse sequences to actually determine such three-dimensional folds of large proteins. And Lauterbur and Enstiel got the Nobel Prize for imaging. Now, just to get you a little bit in tune and to give you a little bit of a picture of what NMR spectra look like and what kind of controls we are using before I go a little bit in the history and a little bit of the background. So this is actually the first liquid state NMR spectrum of a protein. This was already acquired in the 50s. It was a relatively low magnetic field, photon resonance frequency of 40 megahertz. It's a very, not very well resolved spectrum that you see. You see a lot of broad humps here. Actually, this spectrum consists of many thousands of individual resonance lines, but you cannot resolve them in this spectrum. Now, over the years, there was a lot of progress. Yeah.
Those are the protons.
This was the protons. Yeah, but there. Yeah, you can. I mean, in these biological systems, the most important nuclei that are used is protons, but also N15 and C13. So these are, in organic molecules or biologic molecules, hydrogen, carbon, nitrogen. These are the most abundant nuclei, and they are actually isotopes that have spins, and in particular spins 1/2, which have particularly nice properties from NMR point of view. They don't relax too fast, and they can be nicely manipulated. Okay, so this is again the proton spectrum now, some decades later. NMR frequencies have ranged, been increased a lot simply by building larger and better magnets. So here from 40 megahertz, this is to 90 megahertz, it's more than 20 Tesla magnetic field. In NMR, usually magnetic fields, and that will appear several times, and maybe initially when you read NMR literature, a little bit confusing. When people talk about magnetic fields, they will also always talk about frequencies, because there's some precession frequency or some energy gap corresponding to the, through the two spins spin up, spin down, for example, of protons, and that you can translate into frequency. So whenever there's a magnetic field or magnetic field strength, usually you can translate this into frequency. Okay, so many years later, we have these spectra. They are much better resolved than these spectra, but still, there's still a lot of overlap. So with this spectra, you would not be able to actually assign these resonance lines and find a three-dimensional structure of a protein. So that's basically that problem of resolution was solved by the introduction of 2D, two-dimensional NMR methods. Here's an example of such a 2D NMR experiment where you now see correlations of signals, of resonances of the proton spectrum. So if you would project this down to this axis, you would get back the proton spectrum. Here, there's the spectrum of N15. And in proteins, there are a lot of pairs of protons and nitrogens that are next to each other. And each of these pairs you can correlate, and so we can do some experiment. I will not go into the details at all, but just give you a flavor how that is done. So basically, all these NH pairs give rise to such a peak in this two-dimensional spectrum, and that allows you now to resolve all these overlapping resonance lines now in a second dimension. And as I will also mention a little later, there has been a further extension to 3D NMR, 4D, and so forth. So there are high-dimensional NMR spectra people use these days to analyze very complicated spectra. Now, with that introduction of the spectra, and I will come back a little bit how we actually acquire these spectra, what do we actually measure. Let me just point out, since I have this slide here, a key point. So in this case, these two-dimensional spectra, or these cross peaks, what we call them, appear if during the experiment you are able to transfer some what we call coherence, some excitation, some spin state, or some state of the system that is associated with one spin, for example here with this spin S. So this is excited here, and you use some transfer tools to transfer the excitation to another spin that is coupled to spin S. So if you have such spin pairs, and first you have excited one spin, and what is done? So basically with pulses you excite maybe this first spin, then it evolves under its free evolution Hamiltonian, under its Hamiltonian. So you pick up the frequency that is characteristic for this spin. Then you transfer this coherence or this excitation, and I can give you a little bit more details what kind of spin states these are. You transfer this to this other spin, and after this transfer block, the oscillations, characteristic oscillations of this spin now appear in this in this time evolution. And what you do is then basically this oscillation can measure directly. This here you measure, at least in the standard way, by simply incrementing this T1 time from experiment to experiment. So you do many, many experiments, increment this. So basically you have a two-dimensional data set as a function of T1 and T2 of these oscillations. You do a 2D Fourier transform, and then you get such spectra. So one of the key issues in all this NMR applications is, on the one hand, you need to efficiently excite the spin, so you need to create certain coherences that you want. You want then to measure those. You also want to manipulate the spin system such that certain spin states go into other target states, and there can be many different flavors of these target states depending on what kind of physical information you want to get out. The typical information you get out of this is, well, first of all, these resonance frequencies. So for example, this spin pair may give rise to this resonance frequency, resonance frequency of the protons, of the nitrogen, but there's another spin pair which corresponds to this combination. So you get the resonance frequencies, you get information about the coupling, so which spins of the many thousands of these protein, which spins are coupled to each other. There are also experiments, which I will not go into, that allow you to measure distances between these spins. And what people do now on a fairly routine basis is actually to assign spins, these resonances, these many thousands of resonances of a protein to each nuclear spin in this protein, to these thousands of spins, and measure distances between these assigned resonances, and then reconstruct this three-dimensional structure. Okay. Now, what do the experiments look like these days? And again, I will go back to the history, how everything evolved. But if you look at any standard NMR lab these days that does, for example, protein NMR, they have a whole battery of pulse sequences that all look more or less complicated like this. That's sort of typical shorthand way that these NMR sequences are displayed these days. This would be the time axis. Now you have these different lines, each corresponds to a set of pulses or controls that are irradiated at a certain frequency. For example, these are all pulses irradiated at the photon resonance frequencies. This would be N15, C13, and these are actually additional control parameters or additional way to manipulate the system, and that's by switching defined magnetic field gradients on and off. Also, I should mention, I don't know if that appeared, David Tanner said last week that we can send emails to everybody there was this email address. I don't know if you got an email from me last Friday. I sent out a few references, but I think I didn't get it. I don't know if you got it. Yeah, so we have to check. I can send you these later again. Okay. Good. One thing, one thing I want to point out here. So all these cryptic lines that you see that's just a shorthand notation. In the early days, when there was just one pulse or two pulses, people would write pi over it, like 180 degree pulse or pi over two. Nowadays, people just, whenever there's a broad line, it means a pi pulse, 180 degree pulse, this would be a pi over two pulse, a 90 degree pulse. So that's what this is. Here, coherence is excited, for example, at the protons transfer to the nitrogen, let it evolve for this T1 period at this carbon, then transfer it back to the nitrogen. Here it's evolved again. Then you measure here the proton signal. So it's a very complicated way. But a lot of people, many labs, a lot of people, including several Nobel laureates, have worked on really optimizing and trying to get as much information out of this as possible. But what I claim today, all these sequences that I use today are still not optimal. So they are working quite well, but there's still a lot of opportunity to improve these systems, and that's where optimal control theory then comes in. Even though now at first sight the sequence looks complicated, basically it's delays and pulses, but then there are also these periods, these blocks, which are in these NMR representations of pulse sequences, often represented simply as rectangles. So there's one of these curious rectangles, there's another one. And these are actually what NMR people call multiple pulse sequences. So that's a sequence over a prolongated period of time, several tens of milliseconds sometimes, where there are thousands of pulses applied, each with defined amplitude, phase, and timing. So it's even though this looks the most simplest, these are very complicated sequences. And they are often used for what we call heteronuclear decoupling. Again, this I will show you the timeline when all this came in. This was all rediscovered in the area of quantum computing. It's now called bang-bang control, but basically heteronuclear decoupling. And that was that's one application of these. Another is also to so-called proxy experiment, experiments where you transfer coherence from one spin to another, can be done very efficiently with these multiple pulse elements. Actually, here's the architecture of such multiple pulse sequences that are currently still used. And again, they're not optimal. I will show you. But basically, when we optimize nowadays with the tools of optimal control theory, we can actually, for extended periods of time, optimize the best one, or at least one of the close to best pulse sequences that do this. This was not possible many years ago. So when all these multiple pulse sequences were introduced, people tried to reduce the number of pulse sequence parameters so they could either have analytical tools to sort of find good solutions, or do some computer optimization of a few pulse sequence parameters. And that's the typical structure that these multiple pulse sequences have. So basically, you have some basis sequence consisting of a number of pulses, maybe 10 or 15 or 20 pulses, each of a certain duration, amplitude, phase. And then, I mean, in some applications you want to create, for example, a certain what NMR people call effective Hamiltonian. And I'll come back to this. So this idea to not have to live with the Hamiltonian, with the spin Hamiltonian you are given, but being able to manipulate this and tailor this according to your needs, and maybe zero out terms that would make the spectrum more complicated and focus on other terms. A lot of interesting or very powerful techniques have been developed in the 60s already to design multiple pulse sequences that would do that. And for example, in this decoupling business, what you have, one term of your Hamiltonian is a coupling term. Maybe you want to measure during a certain period of your experiment the proton resonances, and the protons are coupled to N15. But this coupling gives rise to splittings, signal to noise gets worse, spectra get complicated. So you would like to create an effective Hamiltonian where this coupling is gone, where the spins of the proton spin behave as if there was no coupling to N15. And such pulse sequences can be devised. So there's a straightforward way with this average Hamiltonian theory to construct such pulse sequences. Again, they're not optimal, but they work, and they have been used a lot. And for example, over a certain extended period of time, maybe several tens of milliseconds, you want to create a certain desired effective Hamiltonian. And what you do then, or what people have done now typically, is to create a small building block that creates this Hamiltonian, and that is just repeated over and over again. So that's what's typically done today. Now, over the years, so I already mentioned, so that in these multiple pulse sequences, and that's again something of nomenclature, so multiple pulse sequences, I mean, applying multi pulses, I mean many, many pulses in such sequences. Again, that goes back to the 60s. Now there have been certain variants, and I will point out some of those at the blackboard that have appeared. So one is called so-called composite pulses, and I will show why it's called composite. But it's actually sort of a subset of these multiple pulse sequences, and there are pulses where these pulses, I said we can change the amplitudes also of these pulses, but there are cases where then these amplitudes were changed smoothly, so this was then called shape pulses in the NMR community. And there have been a lot of pulse sequence parameters, so basically ideally we would like to have some arbitrary shape, and with optimal control basically we can create this these days. But in the like 80s, when such pulses were optimized, it was not, at least large part of the community that did not use optimal control methods. But actually, already in 86, optimal control methods were used in NMR, and I will show you some examples. But most people just try to use just a restricted set of parameters, pulse sequence parameters. For example, here, a few points and amplitudes. Then, for example, you use a spline fit to make a smooth curve through this, or people use Fourier coefficients or sequence of Gaussian pulses with certain widths and position and height, just to reduce the number of parameters of these things. Now, actually, to implement the pulses, of course, typically spectrometers are digitally operated, so whatever smooth pulse you create, be it with some conventional methods or optimal control methods, experimentally it will always be implemented as a series of rectangular pulses with defined duration, amplitude, phase. So that's what it looks like experimentally. And these days, all commercial spectrometers have, and it's just NMR, just radio frequency technology, so it's very straightforward technology. NMR spectrometers are digitally controlled. They're equipped with very sophisticated pulse shaping devices, so basically you can define any shape and the spectrometer will do it. Yeah. Question?
I have two. First, how well are these experiments predictions of the theory agree with what you get in the experiment?
Mm-hmm. So that's a really important question. I think that's one of the key things why NMR is so successful and so far developed. Basically, we have almost a one-to-one correspondence between theory and experiment. So we are in the unique. I will go a little bit into the energy levels that we have, but it's typically finite dimensional quantum system. Usually, we can reduce, the many spins we have, usually we can reduce into blocks of just a few spins. So everything is the Hamiltonians we can very well characterize. And if we optimize some sophisticated pulse sequence, if the experiments don't look as the simulations, then there's usually something wrong. Usually, maybe something interesting is going on. I will show you later an example where it's just amazing how well this fits in a second.
The other one, what people do in laser optimal control is that they try to run optimization algorithm right in the experiment. Well, and that's because the theory and the experiment don't very well agree. Yeah. And so do people do the same thing here?
Yeah. So what? I fully agree. So in laser control, it's just people have put a lot of effort in optimizing shaped laser pulses, but in the end, also what we have heard, sometimes simply the simple ideas work, and the sophisticated pulses. It's always an approximation. We cannot rigorously simulate the thing. So here it's really different. Here, it's by far more efficient to optimize the pulses in the computer and then simply use them and just translate them and copy them on the spectrometer and do them, and they will work. However, people also use some feedback, but it's very slow. So in the NMR, the sort of the repetition time from experiment to experiment would be on the order of second, whereas with lasers you can do this very fast. So it's much more efficient. And then it's also, all these feedback loops, it's not optimal. It's kind of optimal control, but you don't get anywhere near or anywhere. It's not as efficient as the real optimal control methods. So people have done it so far. Actually, I think it's still quite important and successful to use these feedback methods or some learning. But it's usually just sort of to, once you have a very good sequence, then you can refine, the last maybe percent, some experimental imperfections that you're there, you can correct. But it doesn't bring you, it depends on the algorithm, but usually if you're very close to the optimum, and you just do some fine tuning. Okay. So this is a little bit more complicated experiment that actually was just theoretical. We think about implementing this, but we haven't done this, and I'm sure it will work. Oftentimes it's a problem to find the right molecule, the right spin system with certain coupling parameters. These were pulse sequences using optimal control methods we found for quantum Fourier transform. So that's application in quantum information processing. That's a chain of four coupled spins. And that's just a very efficient way to implement these quantum Fourier transform, much more efficient than standard procedures people have suggested to, by decomposing this into some standard gates, controlled NOT, and things like that. You are much faster doing it using optimal control methods. So that's even more complicated sequence. That's a pulse sequence that's relatively recent. I think it was maybe 3, 4, maybe 5 years old. That's a pulse sequence where we do robust excitation in spin systems, and I will show you a little animation a little later where you actually see what the pulse does, and it's quite amazing the kind of control we have, and it's very complicated. The dynamics of the spins that you create with this is also very complicated, but it's working one-to-one basically on the spectrometer. And that's one of the most complicated pulses we optimized. And actually, people, even if I show this to my colleague, they will not believe that their spectrometer can actually can really translate these pulses to the spin, so they do something meaningful. But that's actually the experiment I had in mind when I told you how well experiment and theory agrees and simulations agree. And hopefully, I have time later to show you actually the actual experiment. Okay, so I mentioned before that NMR comes in very different flavors. There are very different ways to manipulate spins. So on the one hand, you have, what kind of sample you're interested in or you try to study. Could be liquids, liquid crystals, solids. I mentioned molecular beams. Again, all kinds of settings. And each setting, the Hamiltonian, or the typical Hamiltonian that you have to take into account can be quite different. So in some cases, for example, in liquids, the motion of the molecules is much faster than the typical time scales where you acquire your NMR signal. So you have an average Hamiltonian, highly simplified Hamiltonian that you have to deal with. Whereas in solids, for example, there's not this averaging. So for example, dipole-dipole interactions are dominating the spectra. And depending on these, the relative size of these certain terms in the Hamiltonian, the experimental techniques and problems you have to solve can be quite different. Then the sample temperature can be very high, low. The spins are actually so well isolated from the surrounding that basically you have to separately also consider the spin temperature. For example, even at room temperature, you can create you can cool the spins such that you are close to close to full polarization, close to zero K for the spin system. So there can be some certain states you want to create. There are many different ways to control nuclear spins. Nuclear spins, typical application, you use radio frequency pulses. Depending on the field, of course, it can go to the microwave range. If you look at electron spins and magnetic resonance, there's nuclear magnetic resonance and electron spin resonance. They're very related techniques. So there, microwave pulses are used. With laser, indirect, you can manipulate the spins with electrical setups. Molecules can be stable, or you want to study maybe a chemical reaction, what is going on there. Detection, usually we use inductive detection, that's the standard way, but then there's squids, there's electrical detection, optical detection, there's a lot of many different flavors of this. But in the standard NMR setting that is used in most NMR labs, and that's sort of the setting I will focus on. We would have liquid state NMR, we have sample temperature is room temperature. It's a macroscopic sample, it's like a small test tube about that size. So we actually can touch it, see it. We use radio frequency pulses, typically stable molecules are used, and we have this inductive detection. So after this introduction background, I want to go, show you a little bit more what you actually measure. Let's look at single spins, couple spins, and what are these pulse sequences, how are they created. Before, I showed you some pictures of proteins, so these very complicated molecules with thousands or tens of thousands of spins sometimes. On the other hand, so there you want to use NMR, you want to use the control techniques to extract the system parameters, to extract all the resonance frequencies, to reconstruct the geometric form shape of this molecule. In other applications, like in NMR quantum computing, you want to use the system to create some quantum logical gates, for example, implement some quantum algorithm. In that case, you don't take an unknown molecule, but maybe you construct a molecule, and for example, about 10 years ago, we actually synthesized this molecule that was the first 5-bit world's first 5-bit quantum computer, where we had these are certain isotopes that we used, fluorine, carbon, nitrogen, and protons. So we synthesized this molecule, then we very carefully measured the system parameters, so resonance frequencies, couplings, and so forth, relaxation times, and then you can manipulate this system and, for example, create interior transformations. So these molecules you make, you dissolve them in this test tube. They are in the center of such a magnet. I will show you another magnet a little later also. And typical parameters these days, maybe it's a 14 Tesla magnet, 600 megahertz resonance frequencies. The largest commercially available magnets these days have something like 900 or even 950, that's the latest development megahertz resonance frequency, so above 20 Tesla magnetic fields. One of the things to bear in mind, the technology to technology of these NMR magnets. It's very advanced. Superconducting filaments are used. People are trying to use now high TC superconductors to push the field limit. And what's important to note is that it's not just the strength of the magnetic field, in many labs, like high field lab, you can get up to 100 tesla, but in order to, for example, study such a protein, the measurement time is very long. So this isolation from the surrounding, which allows us to do these complicated pulse sequences, the coherences, everything survives for a long time, but also makes the technique very insensitive. So these instruments, maybe not this, but for example, this 900 megahertz instrument, I will show you a picture also a little later, it costs several million dollars, and people who want to determine just one molecular structure or one protein, they will use this instrument for maybe 3-4 weeks, 24 hours every day, to get all the information, all the spectral information to resolve the structure. So it's very expensive technique, and it takes so long because the method is relatively insensitive compared to if you measure optical frequencies that you can measure much more efficiently. So in that respect, that's also something I want to point out. That's quite important. Last week we mentioned that there are these situations where I think you mentioned or David mentioned people. Well, if you use optimal control methods, for example, in condensates, or sometimes you are better than what experimentalists do, but they don't really care because they do it already so well. So for them, it's just a complication to make more complicated experiments. Here in NMR, it really matters. More complicated experiments are usually not a problem because technically it's no problem to implement them. But so even if you in an experiment gain this factor of square root of 2, that's something people are very happy to get something like a 20% or 40% gain in an experiment, because that will reduce the measurement time actually by half. So rather than 4 weeks, maybe you need only 2 weeks to use these very complicated, very expensive instruments. And so there's a lot of motivation, a lot of interest in new methods, in further optimizing things, even though they are very well developed, and a lot of people have tinkered a lot. People have just found a lot of tricks to do things very well, which also makes it hard now to do things better, because usually a lot of experimental details have to be taken into account, and it's difficult to do this. But again, I think there's still a lot to be improved and to be done. Now all this is brought together, well, it's called computer control, that's almost trivial. Actually here inside, that's this basically Dewar, what you saw before. It's basically, here's the NMR coil that produces the big magnetic field, for example, 14 Tesla. So the magnetic field is pointing up, for example. I'm not sure if it's up or down, I think up. And basically this whole bottle, this whole container that you see, is just to cool the superconducting coil and to insulate it from the surrounding. And basically inside here, that's where this is the test tube, the sample. And then there's a small coil that produces these radio frequencies, frequency pulses to control the spins. I'll just briefly go through this. Probably I don't need to do this on the blackboard. It's just a very simplified picture of what we are doing. And of course, well, some of you, if you work in spin physics, so this sort of chemistry picture, if you work in spin physics, nuclear spin is a very complicated thing. But here, let's just look at a very naive hand waving picture of what it is. So we have the magnetic field. Actually, the direction of the magnetic field, which usually points up, defines our z-axis. So that's the standard axis in this NMR setting. We have some nucleus, for example, a proton. We can imagine this in a simplified picture just as a charged sphere that is rotating and there's some spin. So we have some electrical current. We create a magnetic dipole field, and it's basically this rotating dipole which corresponds to our spin. So usually we can think of spins as little vectors that create some magnetic dipole field. But the important thing is that these rotating magnets don't align with the magnetic with this external magnetic field. So suppose I suppose this is our magnetic field, and I have a spin. So let's call this the magnetization vector, and I will show you in a second what it quantum mechanically is and how you can actually calculate it. If that is perpendicular to the magnetic field, it wants to align with the magnetic field, like a compass needle wants to be parallel to the magnetic field. But it also has this spin, so it has torque, and basically it will align, but just as a spinning top that you know as a toy, it will not align, but will start just processing motion around this magnetic field. And this precession, that's basically what NMR lives from lives off. These precessions appear in many different settings. Whenever you have magnetic field, you have the spin, and there's an orthogonal component, it will process around this magnetic field. Okay. And we'll come back to this precession several times. Okay, so if you have some orthogonal magnetic moment, but associated with spin, then it will not align with the magnetic field, it will process around this. And this precession frequency is proportional now to the strength of the magnetic field. And this proportional factor is just this gamma, this drive magnetic ratio. So basically, if you manage somehow, and we'll come back to how, I mean, with pulses basically, somehow to bring the magnetizations orthogonal to the magnetic field, they will make this precession motion. So basically, in your test tube, you have this precession motion, and outside you have this small extra coil, not the big coil that produces this B0 field, but the small coil, pickup coil, or coil that also is used then to actually create the pulses. You have now this processing moment, magnetic moment in here. You will induce here some voltage that you actually can measure. So that's the experimental set. I mean, the principle of the experimental setup: strong magnetic field. That's what you really physically see. This big duo with the big magnet, electromagnet. You create these magnetic moments. They process, and their precession frequency induces some voltage that you measure. Okay, this detection coil. So basically, as a function of time, you measure then this some oscillation. Usually it's damped because even these magnetizations or these coherences, even NMR, they don't live forever. So in typically maybe a tenth of a second time scale, you have some damping of these FIDs. FID, that's another term that is used always in NMR. It just stands for free induction decay, so that you induce this signal here, and if you don't give any pulses or anything, you just let the system freely evolve to get this FID, this free induction decay, and Fourier transform this, and that gives you a signal at this frequency. So basically, if the magnetic field is such that this precession frequency, for example for protons, is 600 megahertz, it gives you here a peak at 600 megahertz. So that's basically the detection principle. Now, how do we describe these spin systems? How do we calculate things? How do we optimize experiments? How do we simulate things? So let's start out with a single molecule and one spin 1/2. So I'll just use this little arrow for my spin, and I have one molecule. So it's an isolated quantum system. There's no surrounding, nothing initially. So now I can basically write my state function for this spin as a two-dimensional vector with two complex coefficients. So basically it's the state, quantum mechanical state function of this molecule with the spin, But since the isolation between the spin's degree of freedom and all these spatial degrees of freedom is so good, basically we can ignore, or technically we can trace out all these other degrees of freedom and can simply focus, can reduce this whole state function of the molecule if we look at the NMR experiments simply on the state function for the spins. Yeah.
Sorry, could I ask the previous picture, where does this standing come from?
Oh. Damping up.
Yeah. So typically what it's not is spontaneous emission or something like this. So the frequencies are so low that we are in that regime. So spontaneous the lifetime would be age of the universe, something like this. So it's really interactions. The molecule is not alone. It's interactions with other molecules that are in liquids, but also right, let's look at the liquid case. So this spin here feels the presence of another molecule that is nearby that also has nuclear spins. So they produce magnetic fields, and they are time dependent because these molecules move. And so you have time dependent magnetic fields, and their frequency components that correspond to the resonance frequencies. So it's a stochastic process because each molecule has different neighbors and different dynamics, but it's the interaction with other molecules basically, or with the surrounding.
What is the time scale?
That's on the order of seconds. So it's typically a second.
The other spins also live or precess forever. So it's
basically what you can imagine. So there's suppose you have this one you have typically 10 to the 18 molecules, 10 to the 17 maybe, many molecules, but let's focus on one, and maybe at some point some other molecule just goes by. It also has some spin, some moment, and there's some short interaction, and maybe that causes this spin to flip. So then this one has flipped, but all the others have not. But now, average over this whole ensemble, if there's a flip rate, certain probability that this process will happen. Overall, if you average all these signals, you get this decay.
It's like Brownian motion.
Yeah, it's bound motion that gives rise to this effect then basically. But it's so each for each. If you look at each molecule and sort of in a microscopic picture, you have this long lifetime, and maybe sometimes there's some event and things change. So the phase of the oscillation changes. Just that if you look at then this ensemble average picture, that you get this nice decay. So in this idealized setting, when we have no interaction with the spin, so this molecule with the spin is alone in the universe, we have just two states, spin up, spin down. That's what we know from Stern-Galler experiments. So if we are in an external magnetic field, there are just two basis states we need to focus on. So basically, we can express our state as a linear combination of these two basis states, spin up or spin down. And in Hilbert space, so these are complex coefficients. Okay, and the time, the equation of motion is simply Schrödinger equation for this system. This is the Hamiltonian for this system. Here, these operators, IZ, that's some example of NMR jargon. I will use it again and again, and it has been established over many decades, and it's very efficient to use in this to describe pulse sequences. How do I switch on the? Okay. So here, let's see which one do we have? For example, ISZ. So that's an operator, and that simply means one half sigma z, where sigma z is Pauli operator. So basically, this is one half one minus one zero zero, and then there's ix, which is one half sigma x, and so forth. So these are spin operators that appear. It's very very simple two-dimensional matrices for a single spin one half. Very 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 simple math. Okay, now you have, that's the equation of motion. You can then solve this. So if you give me some initial state of the spin, I can calculate the state at a later stage by applying this unitary operator, this time evolution operator, this propagator, which simply has this form e to the minus iht if the Hamiltonian is constant. And now if you want to measure a certain expectation value of some measurement operator, and typically our measurement operators are, so what we actually measure by picking up these coils, with these pickup coils, is the expectation value of Ix and of Iy. So these correspond to, the coil is in the transverse, this was our z-axis, the coil is oriented in the transverse plane, so it's Ix and Iy what we actually measure. Okay. So that's all very simple, and it's very, very easy to predict what is going on, and that's basically what you could do in the times of Rabi. You can exactly predict what is processing, what is going on. Now in NMR we have this complication that so insensitive that at least with the standard techniques we have to have many, many molecules to detect actually a signal. And I said, well, in the typical settings you have 10 to the 18 molecules in your sample. That doesn't need to be that way. So there's a lot of effort going to developments to reduce the number of spins, and there have been tremendous progress. For example, Dan Ruger, when he uses this cantilever detected NMR, he's down to about 100 nuclear spins that he can detect now. And of course, the goal is to go to single spin, but so far it's still out of reach. But it looks like it's not impossible to actually reach that goal. But again, in the standard setting, we have many, many spins. So again, that's now our test tube. We have, for example, two molecules, but really it's 10 to the 18th. And basically the way to describe this then is, probably you are familiar with this. I'm not sure if you are used to describing things in terms of the density operator. The naive approach would be to try to express this now by some average state function, but that doesn't work because basically, the deeper reason is you always have an arbitrary phase factor for the state function of each of these molecules, and that brings you into trouble. But you get rid of this arbitrary state phase factor by constructing this operator, where you multiply the ket of the state function of each molecule with its bra. And then you can average this over the whole ensemble, and what you get is what's called the density operator. So with that density operator, that gives you a very elegant description of this whole ensemble of many, many molecules, assuming that there's no interaction between these molecules. So assuming you have all this ensemble of non-interacting quantum systems, then this is a very efficient way to describe the system. Now, rather than two-dimensional state vectors, you have these 2x2 matrices. The equation of motion, the Schrödinger equation now becomes this equation of motion. That's called the Liouville von Neumann equation. And so here now that's the time evolution, and this is the way to measure the actual signal. So with this formalism, that's simply for a single spin. That now you can generalize to more than one spin. Here's just actually what I pointed out here already. These are these spin operators, Ix, Iy, Iz, and just simple matrices. And now the beauty of NMR is that, on the one hand, you can look at this as, again, some abstract way, simply as a finite dimensional quantum system. So you have all these energy levels, certain probabilities to be in these levels, certain superpositions and things like that. But the beauty is that over the years, a lot of intuition has been developed, sort of to get a visual picture of what is going on in this quantum system with spins, and it's very nice. A lot of things you can, for a lot of concepts, a lot of dynamics, you can make a very simple geometrical pictures. There's always a limit to the theoretical pictures, to these geometrical pictures. But to a certain extent, it's very powerful approach. And again, it's probably it's far from really optimal. But you can design, and people have designed very sophisticated pulse sequences controls with very simple pictures. And one of the key issues is what I mean, this little M vector that I did draw there, this magnetization vector, which is a nice picture for a single spin, but even for more than, I mean, if you have coupled spin systems, you still can talk about magnetization vectors of each spin. And now how do we define a magnetization vector? So it's simply defined as, I mean, for your ensemble, a vector with three components, and the first component is the expectation value of this spin operator Ix, Iy, Iz. And what's called, well, basically Felix Bloch came up with this, so actually also in the quantum computing world, that's called the Bloch vector also. And in NMR it's usually called the magnetization vector because it's really associated with some microscopic magnetization that you can actually measure with some pickup coil. But of course that's the beauty. So this magnetization vector, this Bloch vector, applies to any, or you can create these expectation values for any two-level system. And in the early 80s, when I did my diploma thesis in Heidelberg, I did laser spectroscopy, and you could reduce the whole system basically to the ground state and the first excited state, and approximate the whole system by this two-level system. And you could also in this you can then define Bloch vectors. In this picture, you can construct echoes, so we measured photon echoes and things like that. So that's a very general picture, and so this Bloch vector is simply also called magnetization vector in NMR. Okay, that's just some example. If you would do then all this, go through this machinery, you can then predict NMR experiments using this density operator, what's called then the density operator formalism. Okay, now let's go beyond one spin. So we started with a single molecule, a single spin. We went to many molecules, each still a single spin. But now we want to have many molecules for each, many molecules, and each molecule has now several spins or many spins. And so it's clear for this one spin, one half, we have these two energy levels, these basis states, spin up, spin down. For two spins, already have four. And for n spins, you have 2 to the n. So there's an exponential growth in the number of energy levels. And that limits us, if you really do the full calculation, to on the order of 10 spins that we can actually simulate exactly without any approximations on the computer.
I have a question to the middle figure. Mm-hmm. So usually, the upper state would correspond to a triplet state, and the lower one was a full triplet state. And then in the middle, we would have like a superposition of these ups and downs.
Yeah, I mean, it depends on the.
Also, the triplet.
But that depends on the strength of the coupling between the two spins. So here, that's the typical NMR setting where the energy differences are much larger than the couplings. So there, that's basically there's no mixing for triplet and singlet. I mean, there's very very little. Basically, there's no mixing. It doesn't make, or it's not convenient, or it's not like in ESR or in some other applications. There are this picture of singlets and triplets. That's very powerful, but here the coupling is too weak. You don't have mixing really in the typical setting.
Do your two arrows have colors? So one belongs to one.
So for example, this one. So here, for example, going from here to here would leave this spin down, but this would go from the down to the up state. Mm-hmm. So this would correspond to the transition. For example, if this is proton and this is N15, for example, this would be 600 megahertz. Whereas this one, if the second spin flips, this could be 60 megahertz. So a factor of 10 smaller. So there are huge differences. And actually, that's something I should write down also. So just look at
these spins are distinguishable because in the molecule you know where is which spin.
Yeah, so in the simplest case, let's assume we just have two spins in the molecule, and one is N15, one is proton, and it's clear. Well, if we have many proton spins, that's something we'll come to, but there basically it's not just the diamagnetic ratio that determines the resonance frequency, but in this molecule, the electrons will more or less shield the external magnetic field, so there's a slight shift of the resonance frequencies. That's this chemical shift. It's called chemical shift because it's because of chemistry, the electrons. And that allows you then also to separate the different spins. And typically what you have is, let's call this the Larmor frequency, or L0. So that's the precession frequency in the external magnetic field. So that could be typically, for example, 600 megahertz. For protons, but maybe just 60 megahertz for N15. So there are huge differences in the frequencies. There are couplings between the spins. So it's called J couplings usually. So the couplings between spins are on the order of maybe 100 hertz. So in typical settings, the couplings is much smaller than the frequency difference between the spins. And the control fields, so I mean, we'll come to the control, but if you use this little coil also to create pulses and to manipulate the spins, and that so that creates a transverse magnetic field. Again, we have precession around this transverse magnetic field, and that's called usually the Rabi frequency. So this, call this Rabi. So that's the strength of our control. Again, frequency units, that's on the order of 10,000 hertz. So it's much smaller than the coupling, much larger than the coupling, but much smaller than these resonance frequencies. And another interesting number is called this delta nu zero. Or actually, just put it up here. So suppose you're at 600 megahertz, then because of this chemical shift, the frequencies depend on the chemical surrounding. So all the spins in the protein, for example, have different spins and different resonance frequencies. So there's a variation of typically, say, 10,000 hertz. So there's a variation, but the variation is very small compared to the frequency. It's in the ppm range, part per million change. And that's also why, and we want to resolve this. And typically, modern NMR magnets are constructed such that they have these frequencies of 600 megahertz, but they are so stable and magnetic field is so constant over the volume where you measure that you can resolve sub-hertz resolution. So it's on the order of 10 to the minus 9 resolution that you have in these spectrometers these days. Okay. Okay, so it's just sort of to complete this formalism. So for single spin, we have the state function. We have two basis functions. For two spins, we have these. We have four. Here we have, in this magnetization vector picture, this block vector, we have one block vector. Here we have two block vectors. If we have two spins, one block vector for each spin. But that doesn't capture the full dynamics. So that's just a small, sort of classical part of the dynamics. In addition, then we have terms in the density operator where also NMR spectroscopists have developed quite some intuition about it, and also some sort of pictures, some geometric representations. And they're called, these additional terms are then called, they have names like coherences, then there's a single quantum coherence, double quantum coherence, zero quantum coherence, there's spin order. There are different types of additional terms that sort of represent to the rest of the quantum mechanical states that you have in the density operator. Okay, so that's just what was already in this transparency. So for single spin, we have this equation of motion, this solution. For this ensemble, now we look at the density operator. We have density operator looks like this. I think we had actually what I no let's go back. What I want to show up here is. So in this case, we have, for these two spins, we have now this, what wasn't transparent already, this four basis states now. And this is the typical form of the Hamiltonian now for two coupled spins. So we have resonance frequencies, so that corresponds to the Zeeman term for the first spin, for the second spin, and then some coupling terms. And but there are very different coupling terms. That's sort of the most common. It's called, on the NMR literature, it's called the weak J-coupling or weak coupling term. In physics literature, that would correspond to the Ising coupling. But there are also other situations. There are a lot of different situations where you have here, like XX, YY, ZZ couplings corresponding to Heisenberg couplings. We have dipolar coupling terms. So if you want to create a certain Hamiltonian, you usually will find a situation that actually allows you to implement this. And again, now for the two spins in the ensemble, you have these 4x4 density operators. And if we have 10 spins, you have 10^24 by 10^24 operators that you have to consider.
For the notation, I have a question. Mm-hmm. So one of the Hamiltonian operators called IZ and the other one is
SZ. Yeah, yeah. So the,
what's the difference between
IZ? It's just the, again, one of these short hand notations that have been established over the years. So the, I mean, that was for a single spin. Single spin 1/2, for example, we have this. Now if we have two spins 1/2, then usually we draw pictures like this. So that's my spin I, that's my spin S. So the first spin is called, I could call it I1, I2, or simply IS, and I don't need any subscripts. And I, for example, I, what do we have here, IX or IZ, whatever, IZ, that's now 1/2. So the first spin is then sigma Z, and tensor identity operator. And SZ would be 1/2 identity operator correspond to the first spin, tensor sigma Z. That's how you go from 2x2 matrices to 4x4.
One question I have, if is there a weak J coupling, because of the two spins and because there's a distance between them, between the spins, is there any distance between them if there's a coupling?
Yeah,
I didn't know if I get the question as the
yeah, I think I got the question. So again there are very different couplings. So I focus on the so-called J coupling because that's the coupling that survives in liquids in solution.
I thought I means it's the J means the weak coupling, the state of the weak coupling. Does it mean it or?
There are certain coupling mechanisms, and one coupling mechanism is dipole-dipole. That's the strongest. That's, for example, in solids, that's what's the most, it's the largest interaction. But in liquids, this dipole-dipole interaction has been averaged out, so we don't have the dipole-dipole. And what survives is what we call the J coupling, which is, for example, say if you have some molecule, let's draw part of a protein. Glycine. These are these NH pairs, for example, that we discussed at the very beginning. There is a dipolar coupling, but that is averaged out in solution. And we can discuss later why it's averaged out, but that we don't see in isotropic solution. But still, the spin of the proton feels the spin state of the nitrogen through an indirect mechanism, not direct dipole-dipole. But actually, the nitrogen nuclei, they polarize the electrons, and then the electrons, this orbital, they then polarize, or then if they have a finite probability to be at the site of the nucleus, then they influence this one, this spin also. So it's called Fermi contact interaction. So there must be finite probability of the electron to be at the site of the nucleus. And then whether it's weak, whether we call it weak or strong, that just depends on the relative frequencies of sizes of these resonance frequencies. Okay, so final thing of the very basics I want to mention is that since we do the experiments at room temperature, usually, and if we don't do any specific experiments, I mean, as I mentioned, we can cool down the spin systems to a large degree, so we can cool them down to Kelvin or millikelvin temperatures, but usually that's not done. So in the conventional setting, and because it's technically very, very complicated, so typically we are in this so-called high temperature limit. The energy difference between the energy levels of the, say, of spin up, spin down, is on the order of millikelvin, but we are at room temperature, so around 300 Kelvin. So basically it's almost equal population probability for the two levels, and it's just this, I mean, just a small excess in the ground state as compared to the excited state, and that's the sort of the polarization that we have to work with. Let me just skip this details. So here's then, as sort of upshot of all this, we have now our density operator that describes our ensemble of molecules with nuclear spins.
Sorry, I have a question to the previous one. Mm-hmm. Is this little difference measurable?
Yeah, that's what we measure. That's our signal.
So maybe out of the 10 to the 18 molecules, there are only 100 or so which are.
Well, it's usually out of a million molecules, there's one more. I mean, you have a million up in the upper state and a million one or something like this in the lower state.
Okay, that's what you mean.
Yeah, the difference. I mean, all the million billion, that's, they cancel. It's just this one additional one in the lower state that we measure. Okay, so the density operator describes the state. We have this equation of motion. I didn't talk about relaxation mechanisms, but I know for those of you have heard, I know one term for this is Redfield theory. It's also something that was developed in the NMR setting, which captures these relaxation processes. So it's a very sophisticated theory. I mean, there are a lot of approximations, but they are extremely well fulfilled in the NMR setting. So we have basically, again, this, I mean, we can predict relaxation processes, not just of these magnetization vectors, also of some sophisticated coherences, very complicated spin states. And also people can extract, by measuring these relaxation rates, decoherence rates, or dissipation rates, you can then conversely get information about dynamics of the molecules, and so there's a lot of back information people get out of this. And then we have these unitary transformations. If relaxation can be neglected, then transformations are unitary. If not, we can take this into account, and so we can calculate the evolution of our density operator. Yeah.
Any non-Markovian dynamics in NMR relaxation?
No, it's usually all considered, everything is sort of Markovian. I mean, there's in the area of electron spin resonance, there the situation is slightly different, there these processes coming, but in NMR it's an extremely good approximation to use Markovian approximation. And okay, so in the last few minutes before we go to before it's 12 o'clock, I want to show you a few examples of control. So this, actually in Munich, that's the lab with the 900 megahertz spectrometer. So actually, I should switch that on. These are the spins, say these two spins. We talked about these resonance frequencies. And now what we have, this additional coil that we have in the magnet, that we can use now to control the spins, to switch on like tiny additional magnetic fields. They are, so if they have to be in resonance with the precession of these spins, so ideally they should rotate, I mean these magnetic fields should rotate with the spins, and we can do that by not irradiating constant fields, but radio frequency fields. That's, I mean, 600 megahertz would be in the radio frequency range. So we irradiate, or we apply oscillating fields with the right frequency, and these are then our controls. So we have, for each spin, basically we have X and Y fields. Usually there's complicated dynamics from the lab frame. You see all these processing spins and the magnetization of this RF pulses you radiate correspond also to some rotating fields. So the simple trick is to go into a so-called rotating frame of reference, and then everything is much simplified. Also, all this trivial complicated dynamics is taken out. The spins, if you're in the rotating frame on resonance with a certain spin, then it's just sitting there, and you can then switch on and off X or Y pulses or additional magnetic fields to control the spins, to, for example, make them rotate to manipulate them. And well, the question of the pulse sequence designer basically then is, well, in a given time, what is the optimal shape, optimal control that you can apply? I did prepare a little, well, but maybe I simply sent you this if you're interested. I'll maybe just run through this. I did prepare a little timeline, but it doesn't make sense to quickly write this down in 2 minutes on the blackboard as I intended. But I can give you a little bit of just timeline of the history of NMR, how, in particular, what kind of pulses were developed at what stage typically. So there were the experiments Stern-Gerlach. There was not really control involved at the time. Then the Rabi experiments, that was 38. And he radiated already radio frequency pulses, so he could manipulate spins and flip them. He got a Nobel Prize then in, 44. So then there were basically pulses. Then 46 was this, basically two groups independently, Purcell and Bloch, Harvard and Stanford. They developed bulk NMR, so in liquids and in solids. They got the Nobel Prize in 52. In 1949 already, Erwin Hahn developed the spin echo. So a combination of 9 degrees and 108 degrees was able to refocus inhomogeneities in the system, and you could sort of revive the signal even though it looked like the signal was already gone. Then in 62 were the first experiments for heteronuclear decoupling, that you switch, that basically you change the Hamiltonian that you are given. You, for example, switch off the coupling terms, and this J coupling term, for example. Then in 66, that's when pulsed full transform NMR was invented. So, I mean, before, people just swept through the frequency range of the resonances and looked at absorption. In 66, then Richard Ernst and Anderson, they developed full transform NMR where they just applied a hard 90 degree pulse, excited the whole spin system, measured this free induction decay, this induction signal, and after full transform got the spectrum that led to a huge, a tremendous increase of signal to noise. So that allowed many, many new applications because signal to noise was much, much better. Then an important milestone was 68. That's when multiple pulse sequences were invented, and actually theoretical tools how to treat them, how to systematically construct very complicated pulse sequences to create a certain desired Hamiltonian. And that's called the average Hamiltonian theory. And the people who did this in 68 were Haeberlin and Wall. And one of the sequences maybe you have heard that was for homonuclear decoupling, that's the famous Wahuha sequence in 68. So very sophisticated pulse sequences already, not optimal, certainly not optimal control, but very sophisticated control. Then the ideas of 2D NMR came on in 71, Jean Genère, and it was experimentally implemented and earlier, but published in 76. Then selective excitations using not just exciting everything, but using certain shape pulses was also invented in the 70s and demonstrated. And then there's a very important concept that I want to briefly discuss, and that was invented already in 79, published in 79, and that's the concept of composite pulses. And me just show you this here, because it's also very very intuitive and very it's good. Can you see? Oh, I use this. And so in addition to these multiple pulse sequences based on average Hamiltonian theory, these composite pulses were the first really sophisticated, there's nothing more beautiful than the simplicity of the Hahn echo, that was already very nice. But the composite pulse ideas, that really opened the idea or the way to optimal control methods and to complicated pulse sequences. And the idea there is, oftentimes you have pulse imperfections. I mean, you have limitations, you have all kinds of non-idealities in your experimental system. And suppose you want to draw this Bloch sphere. Suppose you start with a magnetization vector. And let's just consider for simplicity a single spin 1/2 particle. So we can describe, with this, according to Feynman-Wern-Helbert theorem, everything is captured in this magnetization or Bloch vector. So we started on the z-axis. And you want to bring it to the minus z-axis. So conventionally or typically what you do is you apply a 180-degree pulse. Basically, you irradiate a field in this rotating frame along the x-axis. Spins start to process around this magnetic field. So you just wait until you are down at the minus z-axis. The problem is that experimentally, you have this test tube. Each molecule does not feel the same rate of the same Rabi frequency. Some molecules feel a stronger field, some a weaker field. So actually what happens, some rotate ideally down here, but some overshoot and some undershoot. So you don't have a perfect inversion of the spins. And the idea of Markham-Levitt, in the late 70s, was to combine several imperfect pulses to create a better pulse, a more perfect pulse. I learned, you shouldn't say more, either it's perfect or not, but a better, to make out of imperfect pulses a better pulse. And the basic idea, or it's the nice example that he came up with, and there have been many, many extensions on this, is, for example, 180-degree pulse that I mentioned. So this is replaced now by, this corresponds now, or is replaced by a sequence of 90-degree pulse, x. So we want to create x rotation, for example, 90-degree x, and 80-degree y, 90-degree x pulse. So out of a simple pulse, you make a more complicated pulse. But this pulse is better than the simple one. It's a little longer. You always, in order to compensate for experimental errors, imperfections, you always have to pay a price, and it's usually the sequences are longer. But if it's within the relaxation rates, it's fine, and it's okay. And let's see what this pulse does. It actually has nice interpretation. So rather than rotating 180 degrees around the x-axis, so actually, so here, that's our trajectory, can't slow down. We don't give 180-degree pulse, but just a 90-degree pulse, so we end up here. Now we give 180-degree, so our magnetization vector is here. We give now this 180-degree, x, y, z, 180-degree pulse around the y-axis, so we rotate here 180 degrees. That doesn't matter, because we are already in this y-axis, so we just rotate the vector, it stays, and then we continue with 90-degree rotation, so we end up here. So that's the same thing. But now let's suppose, and I just draw the picture again, it's getting not too crowded. We have the situation where we, for example, undershoot. So the first 90-degree pulse is only, 80-degree pulse. So we go down here. So we have some angle to the y-axis. Now this 180-degree y pulse follows. So that rotates us here around the y-axis. Brings us here. It's not perfect, because it also will be a little bit smaller than the perfect pulse, but almost 180-degree pulse. And then the next imperfect 90-degree pulse, which is again maybe something like 80-degree pulse, will follow. So overall, it will bring us down to the minus z-axis, even though each pulse was not perfect. So they compensate each other's ideas, and it's more or less sort of it's the same idea as the spin echo, that you rotate by 180 degrees around some axis and while doing this experiment. Okay, and based on these composite pulses and composite pulse decoupling has been developed, and again, so many years later, I mean, this was again 79. So in the late 90s, then people in quantum control, rediscovered or reinvented this heteronuclear decoupling, and it's called bang-bang control, for example, nowadays. So then in 84, shape pulses, I mean, arbitrary shape pulses have been introduced and actually implemented. Then actually 85 were the first papers, first application of optimal control theory of actual very complicated pulses developed using optimal control methods in NMR. They were used in the imaging, actually in this NMR imaging area, for example, to selectively excite only part of the spectral range and nothing outside of the spectral range, so very selective pulses. Unfortunately, or I don't know, for NMR, this never caught on, or didn't catch on for quite some time. So after these first papers with the selective pulses in the imaging community, other pulse design methods were invented based on filter theory ideas, which allowed you to create almost the same, and for this particular application, almost the same quality pulses in much faster time. So they just inversion of some equations, and so basically this was never followed up much, but in the very experiment implementation and optimal control was used already in 85. And then it was basically in the after 2000 that people, and in this case it was actually, I have to blame Naveen Kaneja, who came to visit my lab. We discussed, he was interested in a paper in Science we had about boundary of quantum evolution, what we can do in terms of unitary operations for such mixed states. He came, we discussed some open problems, and with his background in optimal control, he he introduced us to the optimal control algorithms with his forward-backward methods. I mean, all of a sudden we had this fantastic tools at hand that we, not as in the early papers in the 80s in NMR, that was only applied then to single spins, uncoupled spins, but now the same methods, they're very general, we can apply them to coupled spin systems, we can create many complicated, very complicated pulse sequences, control spin dynamics in extremely interesting ways. I want to show you one animation,
sorry for the history, you did not mention Richard Hans.
It was a little I did mention him. He was the one who did the pulse Fourier transform techniques. So he introduced that with Anderson.
In 1966.
Yeah. Okay. But then he later introduced also, actually, I mean, Jean Genet had introduced the idea of 2D NMR, but Ernst then really actually implemented it, a group of Ernst. And they also did 3D NMR that I can give you more details later. Let me just quickly go through the, So these are just a summary of sort of design tools that have been used and developed in NMR. So German Tuning theory I measured 60s. This idea of this toggling frame is actually part of this, which is very powerful. There was this introduction of the product operator formalism, which is actually an approximation, but a very good approximation to describe spin dynamics in, it's fine for maybe 95% of the NMR experiments that are actually used. So that allowed a very simple and visual picture rather than going through the full density operator machinery for people to describe and simulate and also design NMR experiments. So that has been very successful. But again, it's kind of limited. But if you know the limits, it's very good. Then there are these building blocks, square pulses, shape pulses, decoupling sequences, multiple pulse sequences. Here are the imperfections or things that we have to consider. That's this variation of the Rabi frequency, RF, rate of frequency inhomogeneity. That's closely related to calibration. So if you miscalibrate the pulse, no pulse is perfect, then it's the same effect that you overshoot or undershoot. You have relaxation effects. You have off-resonance effects, all kind of things, and so basically, in the end, it turns out that all of these things you can consider using optimal control theory. some references. So since 2000, now there was a flurry of activities and results, applications in liquid state, solid state NMR, electron spin resonance, applications to find time optimal transfer schemes in coupled spin systems. They have certain initial states that you want to go to bring to a final state. Relaxation optimized sequences. Actually, it turns out that in many situations, and that's quite counterintuitive, you think that, well, if you have dissipation or decoherence, you want to do things as fast as possible, so you lose as little as possible during your transfer. Turns out, since we know this relaxation superoperator, we know the mechanisms very well, in many cases it turns out that the optimal procedure is not to do this as fast as possible, but to follow a certain trajectory in your in the space that you have available, and follow a trajectory such that along the way you lose as little as possible through this decoherence. Now, experimental constraints, robustness is a very important issue to take into account. And what I wanted to point out, that we do have all the numerical tools for optimal control theory. So we use all these numerical things, and they are indispensable in really, if we go to really realistic settings with limited RF rate, control amplitudes, with imperfections, with all kinds of things we have to consider. But in this finite dimensional systems, there are also a lot of very powerful tools for optimal control theory that allow you to derive analytical solutions, closed form solutions, and where it's possible, and Naveen has been able to show a series of beautiful examples, where it's possible to show to find the global optima for certain problems. What is the best efficiency, what is the best possible pulse sequence to achieve certain goals. So that's really something that is probably is unique to these finite dimensional quantum systems, where you can write down closed form analytical solutions. So now let me just jump to this animation I want to show you. And let's see. And this is just an example where I illustrate these ideas, these effects of these imperfections, just one more time. So here, in this case, I don't want to have the problem to not invert the spin, but for example, to bring it here along the x-axis, for example, y minus y-axis, whatever. And well, if everything is perfect, I switch on my pulse, I switch it off again, I'm ending up here. In the case where I have a variation of Rabi frequencies, then we have this overshooting, undershooting, we have the slow and fast spins. In the case, and that's another important issue, so we not only have, and we just not have just one spin, even for the protons, we have hundreds of proton spins, so we can sit on resonance for one, but all the rest will be off resonance, so there will be an off resonance effect, and that results in the field that the spins feel. It has the control field in the transverse plane, but it has some offset term, so it's not, the spin is not rotating around the vector in the transverse plane, but in some tilted vector. And if we have that effect, that's what you have. So we have this fanning out of your magnetization vectors. And in practice, you have both. You have these off-resonance effects and these inhomogeneities. So basically, that's what the spins actually do in many situations. So if you have very large frequency ranges, you think you apply a 90-degree pulse, you think everything is along the x-axis, but if you look what actually happens is, they're all over the place. And if you do some complicated NMR experiments, you can get into a lot of trouble. You lose a lot of signal if you filter out just what the spins are supposed to do. So here's the same animation where you have that sort of resolved. Here's now resonance spins with different resonance offsets. Here's different scaling of the Rabi frequency from this area. And well, what one can do is to study this as a function of offset. What is the pulse duration? What is the quality factor? Well, these are typical pulses you find initially, but then you find more complicated pulses. Let me just go after all this preparation. Okay, actually, so this is just an example. For example, in order with a certain RF amplitude, 10 kHz, we can cover 20 kHz field, but much faster compared to conventional composite pulses, and we can go to much larger bandwidth for these pulses compared to known sequences. And this is the pulse I showed you initially to begin with, and that's the action of this pulse. That's animation I wanted to come to. I wanted to show you at the end. This pulse was designed to be a robust broadband excitation pulse. The RF amplitude, the nominal RF amplitude, is 15 kHz, but we want to cover 50 kHz, which is much larger than the strength. We also wanted to have robustness with respect to scaling of the radio frequency amplitude, so depending on where our molecule is. So its nominal amplitude is 15 kHz, but we wanted to work the pulse to work between 10 and 20 kHz. So a factor of 2 in Rabi frequencies, all spins should be excited to the minus y-axis, for example. And I will show you the animation in a second, but so you see it's not science fiction. These are experimental results. So we implemented this pulse in the spectrometer and did it. And here we actually changed all the offsets. We acquired a spectrum of some test molecule, changed the resonance frequencies. Here we changed the dB value, so that we scaled the Rabi frequency. And for all this range, basically, we get perfect excitation. It was optimized at plus minus 25 kilohertz. You see outside, we see the first imperfections. So outside, it breaks down. But for the area where it was optimized, it works perfectly experimentally. And now you'll see what the spins actually do. Here's at top is just again what the hard pulse does, so the rectangular pulse. Here's our pulse that we optimized. Actually, it's simply phase modulation. The amplitude is constant, which is nice because then there's no nonlinearities of amplifiers, and phase switching is very accurate. And so here's now the dynamics. Again, this is resonance offset. This is scaling of radio frequency amplitude. The spins go all over the place. Let's see. Time progress. So we are about one third into the pulse. So somewhere here. It looks crazy, but that's what the spins do.
Yes, you get them dizzy.
Somebody, when I gave a talk earlier, somebody said it looks like a very windy day. So, but now we are reaching the end. And you see at the end of the pulse, basically everything is aligned. It's what we call basically a perfect, not perfect, but a very, very good robust pulse that is optimized for a whole ensemble of spin system parameters that covers it at the same time. And we have implemented this in 2D experiments that we get. We can easily find situations where the conventional sequences don't work at all, completely break down, and still this gives full signal. Okay, so I think with that I should stop. Thanks for attention.
Mm-hmm.
So, is it possible to explain in a few words how do you numerically insert robustness into the numerical goal or price function, whatever you use?
Yeah, it's very simple. Show you. So we use this basically forward and backward algorithm. We don't use what you call the local algorithm that goes step by step. We played a little bit, and certainly not the best way yet what we're doing, but it's extremely powerful and it's many orders of magnitude better than what we could do earlier. We actually use a gradient, the very basic standard gradient method. We don't use this iterative approach where you take into account the condition that the overall energy of the pulse should be minimal, because in many applications, there are applications where it's an issue, but in many applications it's not an issue. So it's an artificial constraint that you would include. So we leave that simply open, simply use the gradient. We limit the maximum amplitude that can be achieved, but the energy is usually of no, in many cases at least, of no concern. So basically what this then amounts to is, well, I mean, initially when Naveen came to us, he derived everything with, I don't know, Pontryagin's maximum principle and like standard formalism. And people in NMR like to, I mean, they had no idea about this, but actually it was possible that in this case, actually you can just derive everything as, straightforward gradients using variational principles. So basically what we have is, we have this desired transfer, we have some performance index, we have our density operator that we evolve forward in time, we have this lambda, basically this Lagrange multipliers going backward in time from the target state, and that, basically calculating commutators and projections, we get this gradient in a very efficient way by just one forward, one backward calculation. And basically now if we have this robustness, we want to have robustness, if you do the math, it's very simple. I mean, basically you want to have the best averaged, maybe you have even some weighted average for certain system parameters, but you want the best overall performance. Basically you have a sum over this with some weighting factors, which simply directly translates into averaging the gradient. So simply calculate the evolutions for all these different system parameters and average the gradients and go in the direction.
Evolution one time with some average gradient, or you run evolution many times with every time with a different Hamiltonian?
Say again?
You run evolution one time with some average Hamiltonian? Or
No. We have to do it with each individual Hamiltonian. If you give me 1 second, I will show you one little thing. This is actually, just coming back to your earlier question, how well does theory and experiment coincide? I mean, now with these optimal control pulses, we have, before again, people were restricted to 20, maybe 50 pulse sequence parameters. Now we have tens of thousands, we can optimize hundreds of thousands of parameters. And so what we optimized is this RF scaling, I mean this robust pulse with respect to RF scaling, so depending on where you are in the coil, the pulse will work, and resonance offset, for each resonance frequency it will work, so that's this frequency dispersion. And since we have so many pulse sequence parameters available, we thought, well, maybe we can not simply have a uniform excitation of all the spins, maybe we can have arbitrary excitation, maybe here no excitation, we can maybe create arbitrary patterns. And one of the patterns that we designed was JMR, which is sort of the logo of the Journal of the Magnetic Resonance, the house journal of the NMR community. We had hoped to make it on the cover picture of JMR, but they didn't like it, or I don't know. They had some better picture at the time. But so we picked this, and what it means is for all these different, for all spin systems, these different different combinations of these scaling and offset. For example, whenever it's white, you want the spins to be along the x-axis. Whenever it's black, you want them to be along the z-axis. So we took this as a target. We optimized this pulse. It was this very complicated pulse I showed you earlier. So that's the computer. Then we actually simulated how well the pulse approaches this this target. So that's this. Probably one could do better, but it was good enough for us. So in the simulation, this looks good. So whenever we wanted the spins to be excited, they were excited. They were not excited. And then we copied this pulse to the spectrometer and actually, like point by point, repeated the experiment with different scaling of the RF and changing the offsets and just systematically going through this. And if it and that's what. So this simulation, this experiment, and I mean even very small details. Things you see again in simulation. So it's just a wonderful correspondence between simulation and experiment. Okay. Thank you.